This is a Power 98.7 podcast. Now we're talking. Subscribe to Power 98.7 podcasts in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. There's more on power987.co.za.
And of course, it is a Tuesday. It can only mean one thing. We bring you the Knowledge Bank. And this morning, we are discussing an autobiography titled Child of the Soil. My Life as a Freedom Fighter by Ditlapa Mphahlele, a cutthroat truth teller. And talking about truth, this is what he had to tell the Truth and Reconciliation Commission.
And I dare say the TRC is more concerned with the white life, because even the questions are being filtered by a man who benefited hugely from the dispossession of our people. Because as far as I'm concerned, he who benefits by crime is guilty of that crime. And every white person in this country benefited from the crime of dispossession, benefited from the crime of colonialism, benefited from the crime of apartheid. But now you want to extract yourself from this crime. And it is so displeasing that the grand sons and daughters of Mushweshwe, of Shaka, of Sikukuni are now bearing the burden of their abusers. Because you abused us. All in all, the TRC doesn't encourage people to speak truth. And I dare say this whole fuss, this whole circus is doomed for failure. It's doomed for failure for obvious reasons. Because you cannot reconcile the dispossessed and the dispossessor. You cannot reconcile the oppressor and the oppressed.
Well, on that note, 10 minutes past 11, Litlapa Mphahlele joins me on the line. Ntate, good morning to you.
Good morning to you, Lukona, and good morning to your listeners.
Well, I know that with that clip, I've not taken you too far back in history, because in your book, you take us to your place of birth. So, I'm looking forward to this conversation. Perhaps talking about your place of birth and, you know, of course, growing up in Manaleng, in the then Northern Transvaal, perhaps paint us a picture about, you know, I know you were not born in Manaleng. You moved there 9 months after a birth, if I'm not too mistaken. Paint us a picture of, you know, those formative years of coming to being in this soil of Africa.
My parents were born, whereas there was a firstborn before me who did not live long. I had to inherit everything he had, including his name, so including his position. As a matter of fact, I'm regarded as a firstborn. So I would into gender so to traditions. A firstborn is supposed to be delivered at the mother's place. My mother's place is in Rosengans, north of Polokwane. And that's where I am told I was born. Then from there, when I was 9 months, mother went to a marital place, which is Manaleng. Well, growing up there, if there was one period of my life that I cherish most, that I enjoyed most, that's my childhood. It was a series of happiness. We enjoyed playing with self-made toys, and the company, the family. My father, as a matter of fact, he only visited us during weekends or when he was on a leave. He worked in nearby town. Then it was called Aspect. Now he named Poluku. So in the family, there was great-grandmother, paternal, mother, and my Mufeti. Mufeti is someone who looks up after a newly born child. Normally would be someone either from the father's side or the mother's side. In this case, it was Mani, my aunt Machweni. And it was so painful because the elders were there and we shared everything, including food. And of course, I remember those days when weddings, everybody was invited. And in the days preceding the wedding, the actual wedding, a month or so, we would be practicing songs, people would be, you know, dancing, not it would be in a moonlit night. And of course, there's one song, which meaning touched me, Africa, the land of our forefathers has been repossessed by the white people. And this song was to shape my life in adulthood.
And now I wonder, I mean, in those young years, you were still very young. How did you inherit, I mean, like a nickname, Sputnik? I mean, there's a point in time where I think father had left you behind. And then you get into, finally you make it home from a nearby village, still at a very young age. And of course, your mother there calling you Sputnik, Sani Sani, Kamiti, Kanyati, Kaderi Meleke. And I'm wondering, I thought about Bango Dairy Meleke, people who are light in complexion. How do you get these nicknames?
I have so many nicknames. I did not write all of them.
Yeah.
Let me begin with Sputnik. That was around the time when the Russians were actually leading the space exploration. Race. And remember, the Russians were the first to send some person in the outer space, Yuri Gagarin.
Yeah.
I think it was in 1961. So, Sputnik, I think it was one of the most famous names during those days. So, mother, even to this day, elderly people call me Sputnik. And Sony, I think it's from one of the famous radios then. It was Sony. Sony can meet. You can meet. It means meat as inedible food, meat. Kanyati. Well, it's because we are not very good in pigs. Kanyati, you know, is meat, is the same thing. Kateri Melek. Very well. Mm. It's the same as milk, yes. So, yes, I was brought by having parents, especially my mother, who fortunately is alive. She still calls me Sputnik.
Yeah.
And of course, it was, but that's one thing. When I presumed lost, when I reunited with the family, that I realized the depth of my mother's love.
It seems like you were said to be a revolutionary from the very onset, given those nicknames. But, I mean, your life does not necessarily start off on a very political and politicized note. In fact, when time comes for you to go to initiation school, you defer a lot to your Christian values, to a point that your Ndade's elder sister says to you, well, I hear you, child of my child, if you choose to follow the Christian God, stick to him and to him alone. Don't mix him with other gods. If you mix them, you will get mad and collect rubbish at the dump. And but eventually, I mean, you end up at initiation school. Just give us a sense of how you encounter Christianity, and whether or not, you know, as you then grew up as an adult, your views around Christianity evolved and perhaps changed.
Yes, I became a born again Christian. That was after I took ill, and it was so serious that I foresaw my death. So I wanted to be in God's good books before I died. So I must say, I became a fanatic because I shunned all the customs of the family. Even when my grandmother died, one of the people I loved so much, you know, throughout my life, I couldn't attend a funeral because there were going to be rituals, traditional rituals that are being performed there. And afterwards, I was going to get my head shaven. So I just felt that the practices of the heathens were too much for me. But as for initiation, remember, among people, I would say among the baby people, we go twice if you are men, only women go once. The first one is Budikana. I went to Ghana at the first initiation phase before I was converted into Christianity. Well, I always regarded myself as Christian because the Family Church is Methodist Church. People who attend the Methodist Church, you know, would go for initiation, do everything. But now, again, a Christian was different. And in the interlude, the first phase and the second one. The second one is Wera, which takes place a year after the one. Then I was a born again Christian, so I refused to go there. My father actually had to take me by force, and I ended up in the initiation. And I think that phase of confrontation prepared me to be an atheist in my later years, because I just realized the rationality of Christianity in an African setup, especially where a convert actually turns against the culture of their own people. But my struggle with God and God's existence started very early, even before I converted into a born-again Christian. I always had question about the existence of God, because I did not understand that God's children, some were white, others were black, Africans, and some were dominating others in their own land. And God seemed to be indifferent. And those are some of the questions that troubled my mind. But fortunately, at the age of 20 years, I was liberated from the practices, I mean, those traditional beliefs of witchcraft, etc. And even believing in God, then I became an atheist.
Let's take a pause. I want to pay some bills. There is also just a small thing that's troubling me on that line, Snetemba, that I'd like you to try and see if we can get a seamless connection as we continue this conversation. We are doing this Knowledge Bank with a book review, Child of This Soil, My Life as a Freedom Fighter. Ditlapa Mphahlele joins me on the line about his autobiography. And 0861-987-000 is the dial for you people of power if you have a question for him. I mean, this is someone who's lived life in many ways, and I will ask him after this his moment of political awakening. We will also talk about some figures that he encountered in exile, you know, in the countries like Botswana. We will also reflect, I mean, when his photos were out on TV and newspapers because he was being charged with terrorism, murder, attempted murder, and arson at the eve of the 1994 elections. Well, 0861-987-000, do join us. This is our conversation. 23 minutes past 11.
Knowledge Bank.
Indeed, it is the Knowledge Bank. 24 minutes past 11, 0861-987-000 is the dial. My guest, Litlapa Mphahlele, is on the line. Now, let's talk about that, you know, moment. You call it in your on your 20th year, in your 20s. There is a moment of political awakening. And what introduces, I mean, this awakening quite forcefully to the point that, you know, you almost move to an extreme end of your conscientization and consciousness?
You mean political awakening?
Yes. At what point do you think that happened in your life?
Well, it evolved. It was not an event.
Mm.
Because growing up in my village, we used to encounter white people. They would normally come to buy pigs and sometimes even crops like millet, sorghum. And actually, they would tell how much they were going to buy a pig. And the laws of commerce is that the buyer the seller dictates the price, not the buyer. They were buyers and they were dictating the price. I found it as anomaly. And another encounter with white people, it would be in a special church, Methodist church occasion, when a white priest would come and preach to us and would preach, brotherhood, would preach good neighborliness, you know, all positive things that you can think of.
Mm.
And afterwards, you would go and live in a different world. These are some of the things that I question, that if he was one of our brothers, then he must live with us, or we go and live with him. And another day would be 16th of December. Then huge numbers of white people would invade the village on motorbikes. And without being told, you know, we ran for safety. And anyone who ventured to go out would be beaten up. And they said they were revenging or avenging for Dingaan's death centuries ago. So all this combined, and another event that really happened and radicalized me, was the death of Nkgopotsi Dhiro in Botswana. Killed by a parcel bomb, then the death of Steve Biko in prison, because even in village, people who do not understand politics murmur among themselves that there is injustice going on. Of course, somebody who was a student at Fort Hare then told us about the death of, I thought he was saying Sobuza. Later on, I found that and he said he was saying Sobuko. So, yes, all this, you know, accumulated into making me aware. And later on, I decided that I had to leave the country and join people who were told they were terrorists.
Mm.
And actually, when I went into exile, I was going to be a terrorist because I didn't know the difference between a terrorist and a freedom fighter. But I like terrorists because that's what they were doing a good job.
Well, in fact, you then also go and end up in Botswana and you encounter other, you know, interesting individuals like Tsietsi Mashinini and Kgutso Sithole. How were those, you know, moments? How was it to wake up and realize that indeed, not only were you waking up in a different country, you had actually managed to pass safely into a different country. And now here you were, as you call them, the terrorists, but these revolutionaries who were at the forefront of the liberation struggle.
Yeah, whereas mine was not a dramatic exit from the country because I actually had my passport. So I safely, you know, skipped the border with the understanding that I would come after a week. That's what I told immigration people. And at first, I joined the ANC with the persuasion of the police in Botswana. Later on, I was told that actually Botswana police were being paid, you know, to recruit for the ANC, especially people like me who were political blank at the time. And whilst I was waiting for the ANC officials to come, someone advised me that I should do other things, like going to Home Affairs, go to Botswana Refugee Council, you know, to regularize my stay in Botswana. Well, I'm not sure if they did come, but later on I met someone. I will never forget him. He's Tom Nkwana. I'm told now he's in the U.S. So he recruited me to SSRC, Associate Student Representative Council. That's where I met, you know, my heroes, my icons, you know, people that I respected so much. I honored them. People like J.T. Mashinini and Khoto Seatrulo. And very humble, of course, whereas J.T. could be arrogant sometimes, because I remember one day he asked me for a walk, and he criticized both the PC and the ANC, and he said he was going to command the liberation forces into the country and to fight the bloodiest war in Africa. Yes, but the man was brave. Khoto, very tiny. I think his nickname was also Tiny at the time. And, of course, very intelligent and very... He was never emotional, even when there were crises in the country. Yes, and a lot of other luminaries of June 16, like Majaka Thata Mokoena and others.
Yeah. Now, after this short break, I'm just going to break a bit for news headlines. I do want to come back, you know, continue on Botswana, where you write quite elaborately about Ace Mqashe, just to introduce us to Ace Mqashe and others that you mention in that particular chapter, after the deaths of Harari and Makubalo in an accident. It's really nice as well to use these autobiographies as a moment to reflect on other contributors to our liberation struggle, and of course those who contributed in different ways, not just only as in the armed wings of these liberation movements. Others were writers, others were journalists, and so much more. 11:30, Katlego Legodi.
Power Talk with Lukhona Mbuni. Call Lukhona on 0861-987-000.
Indeed, please call us as we bring you the knowledge bank. Child of this soil, my life as a freedom fighter, book by Litlapa Mphahlele, who joins me on the line. Now, I want to talk more about, you know, Botswana, 1985, of course, South African soldiers raided ANC houses in Gaborone and killed 14 people. And you say that Ace wrote a scathing article demanding to know why the Botswana Defense Force had not repelled the attack. Just give us a sense of, I mean, in that moment, the people that would have been around Botswana, the Ace Mqashes. Who was Ace Mqashe?
We fondly used to call him by Ace. His real name is Mxolisi Mqashe.
Oh.
He was one of the first people to be convicted on Robben Island and sentenced on Robben Island. I think it was in 1962. He was a student then. And, of course, on his release, he went into exile. He studied further his studies in Zambia. I think that's where he did journalism. I could be wrong, and I don't know the latest in Botswana on journalist front. But then he was the most popular journalist in Botswana. He was working for Botswana Guardian, a weekly newspaper. It used to be out on Friday. And people would literally queue, long queues, you know, to buy it, just because of Ace. Even before the raid on Gaborone, he was critical of cabinet ministers, especially their behavior, and sometimes rigging of elections, where even the High Court had to intervene and ordered for the election, and later on, people who cheated emerged victorious. and the ruling party actually lost that constituency. It was in Gaborone. And it was a thorn in the flesh of the ruling party. And but, of course, it was not until the raid that he questioned a lot of excuses which were advanced by Botswana Defense Force about the spikes which were strewn on the road. He asked why didn't they overfly them, because they've got helicopters and aircraft, and lots of questions. Well, they found an opportunity to actually withdraw his work permit and declared him a persona non grata. Of course, he was moving from embassy to embassy looking for the third country, a country that would give him political refuge. Well, later on, some powerful voices in the ruling party said all people who were declared persona non grata had to wait for their next move in prison. So he had to be in prison. I remember going there to see him. His spirits were high. And of course, later on, the USA gave him a political asylum. And I think just on the eve of his departure, he wrote a very, very powerful article detailing how he used to view the USA. But he said, if we view USA as a land of imperialists, we are demeaning people like Malcolm X, Martin Luther, and many other revolutionaries. So he said in his life, he never thought he would go to the USA. But because they are also great people, liberators in the US, then he goes there without any sense of feeling guilty of going to an imperialist country.
Absolutely. I mean, that's such an interesting and reflective moment. People of Power, 0861-987-000, Child of the Soil, My Life as a Freedom Fighter by Litlapa Mphahlele. Now, let's talk a bit about, you know, your then, I mean, you do say you went to exile, first joined the ANC. I mean, eventually you end up in the PAC. You play a significant role in the Azanian People's Liberation Army. How did that come about?
Well, at the time I joined the PAC, I went to the PAC office basically to join ABLA because I had problem with the PAC.
You had problems with the PAC itself.
Now, and all credit to Brais Mkrache, who is no more. At one time, I was so disillusioned that I wanted to leave the PAC. And we nearly spent the whole night. He persuaded me not to leave the PAC. So, yeah, but when I went to PAC offices or house at the time, I found one of the greatest liberation commanders this country has ever produced, Mabatu Enoch Zulu. Yes, and of course, the man personality was humbling. He was serving a meal and actually gave me a spoon, and I was hungry. He said, "Let's share," and we shared the meal. And later on, I told him that I want to join ABLA. I want to be a soldier of ABLA. I've heard so many stories, negative things about the PAC. So I thought that it's possible to join ABLA without
going through the PAC.
Yes. Then he told me that, no, actually, I was wrong. It is the party that deploys individuals according to their talents. So first, I must join the PAC, and the PAC can take me to school if they see inclinations scholarly inclinations in me, or they can take me to military training. Well, it was a 50-50, but I said... Well, I never regarded myself as a type of a soldier. So, but I thought that, you know, it's one way of taking me to school.
Yes.
So, but anyway, later on, I went to Dar es Salaam. And actually, after military training, they secured a school for me in Gambia.
Wow.
Yes, I left the camp. I went to Dar es Salaam. While they were sorting out papers to go to Gambia to further my studies, I don't know how they changed their mind. They said, no, I must go back to the camp. I felt so elated, you know, that they did not take me to school. Well, I was an ordinary cadre of APLA. Later on, I became a platoon commissar, that is political commissar. Then I rose through the ranks until I was appointed member of high command, the logistics section. Later on, when I was in prison in Botswana, I was told that they had appointed me DPT, political commissar, deputizing General Mofokeng, Mohato Mofokeng. Then, upon release from prison, then they appointed me to be director of operations. That was the highest rank I held in the APLA.
In fact, I just want to take some two calls for you, after those calls, I do want to go back to when you were in prison. You spent some time at the Gaborone Central Prison, and there's an interesting conversation you have with Desai as you were on a hunger strike. I want to come back to that and just get a sense of how those moments were, but also perhaps talk about hunger strikes as a form of political action and whether you believe that they do achieve what is it that people who pursue them seek to achieve. McCoy in Cape Town, good morning.
Good morning, Lucan. How are you doing?
I'm well. How are you this morning?
I'm very well, man. The son of the soil, how are you doing, man?
I'm fine. How are you?
Very well, thanks. I just want to crack some jokes with you, man. Regarding him, Lucana, refusing to go to second phase of the initiation. Was he not told that if you're not going there for a second time, you are going to lost your mind or something like that? Because in our culture is that if we have these two initiations where you go first time and then you go the second time. But other ones they are going for the first time, then they finish. They go Bowera and then they go Wudika at the same time, same year. So with him not going there for the second time, what was he thinking about that? No, I'm not going there. But the father is forcing him to go there.
Okay.
Was he not afraid of losing the mind? Because sometimes we are being scared that, no, if you're not going there for the second time, then you are going to lose your mind or something like that.
Got you loud and clear. Darren Patel.
Yeah, no, I wasn't afraid of losing my mind. Actually, I was liberated from those beliefs at that time.
Okay.
And actually, there's even a strong belief that if you go there and you run away, that's when you're going to lose your mind, even if you don't run away, because there was a man in the village who was rescued by the police and he never got his mind right. But I suspect it's because he was thinking heavily. So I was liberated from those beliefs. But the reason why I did not run away is because I knew that my mother believed in them. Maybe it was my mother who was going to lose her mind, but not me.
Interesting. I've got Sifudi on the line. Sifudi, good morning.
Morning to you and Boko Des. You know, CLC Mashinini said it in the 70s that the PAC was dead, ANC was dysfunctional. You can say, Mr. Litlape, that he was arrogant, but he was calling it as it is. And I'll just tell you one thing. The issue of land is still staring us in the face. The people who propagated that policy are failing to take advantage and take the cudgel and free us. What is really ailing the PAC, Mr. Litlape? Azapo is dead. ANC is dysfunctional. That guy was, you know, prophetic. What has gone wrong with the black man? Failure to have unity, failure to address the issue of an African question. We are caught in a time warp. Good morning to you.
Good morning to you, Sefudi. I mean, this idea, I mean, of these liberation movements already at that time, as you say it yourself, you had problems with the PAC, showing, you know, some instances of weakness, which some may argue that have persisted long after 1994 as that moment of transition to democracy. What are your reflections on that?
Well, weaknesses have always been there, and I cannot defend the indefensible. By declaring PAC dead, or even Azapo dead, wouldn't be right, because remember, what makes an organization a living organism is the ideas that it propounds. For instance, a PAC propounds Africanism. Can you say Africanism is dead? Azapo propounds black consciousness. Can you say black consciousness is relevant in the present setup? I don't think so. Yes, but of course there are some things that we look at the numbers at the election, but we forget that these parties that are doing well, they are pursuing somebody's agenda, and somebody is actually funding them. But because PAC and Azapo, you know, are so principled, somebody was joking that they are going to die of their being so principled, because I don't remember at any time PAC dancing to anyone's tune. That's why PAC leaders from Sobukwe to the current president, Mzwanele Nyonto, they speak out of their mind, because no one would come and say, say this, don't say this. Yes, but declaring them dead, I don't think will be a correct verdict.
I want to come back to that moment of you in prison. I mean, you encountered Desai during a hunger strike, and Desai, as you say, was deeply sympathetic and persuasive. And of course, you flatly rejected his proposal that you eat, since he was claiming that you are sick and you can't sustain this hunger strike. But you say, nothing would torment me as much as the memory of such weakness, immediate gratification at the expense of well-understood principles. Desai's face fell in disappointment. At that moment, just give us a sense, I mean, also about the effectiveness of a hunger strike. But when you look back to those moments, would you have remained as resolute as well if you were to be given a second chance?
Yeah, it has been on hunger strike several times, even here in South Africa post-1994. Actually, I started in Lesotho. And I continued in South African Bedlam, where I was kept. So, but this hunger strike, and thanks, I have that experience, because people who know me, I love food. Actually, I'm one of the biggest eaters I know. But now, when you take a decision to go on hunger strike, you must triumph above animal need. This is what the police in Bethlehem used to do when I was on hunger strike. They would bring spicy food, you know, into the cell as a temptation that I would eat. The following day, they would find them as they were intact. But the pains of hunger, to all who have gone through hunger strike, are just for 3 days. The first day is bad. The second day is worse. The worst day is the third day. Then the fourth day, you feel no hunger whatsoever. I'm told biologically, that's when the body starts to eat into itself, converting protein into starch. So, and of course, decide. Fortunately, I once met him in Johannesburg CBD. He's old. Then he persuaded me deliberately, because in that section, as someone who was on a hunger strike, I did not go for workshops. So I was left alone. But they decided, said he was ill, then he was left alone. Then he persuaded me to eat, and he even said he used to help other hunger strikers in the past, who spent a long time without dying. Yeah, but of course I resisted it, and it would have haunted me even now that I told my inmates that I was on hunger strike and I was eating.
And you were eating on the other side.
Yes, of course, I was so disappointed.
I know. I mean, you put it quite aptly there in the book. I'm going to take a short ad break. I've got Steve Libello on the line who has a question. I also have a tweet from Lorato Tsingeng, and I'll put those to you for a response.
Tweet Lukhona at Lukhona Mguni and hashtag Power Talk.
Indeed, but for now, let's go to that line 0861-987-000. Bra Steve, good morning.
Hi, Lukhona, and hi, Mpatsele. I think Mpatsele refers to, you know, that period when CSC Mashinini made the statement he made. Mm. And this was around September 1976. But I think the context is particularly important here, because it did have, you know, that statement actually did have some long-term impact, you know, in the ways in which both the ANC and the PAC were able to recruit, you know, the new cohorts that was coming out of the Soweto insurrection of 76. And the reason why CAT would have decided or had said at the time that the PAC was dead and the ANC was defunct, it is because expectations, you know, from the class of 76, when they left and we went to exile, our expectations were that, you know, we would find a very vibrant, active, you know, kind of ANC and MK and PAC and Botho. But I think what we found then repeatedly, you know, those that went into MK and into Angola keep saying that when they arrived, there's absolutely nothing. So the reality here is that at the time, you know, both the PAC and the ANC were in almost a state of paralysis. So it has to be said that it was not a useful bravado.
Yeah.
But I think it was, you know, quite an honest assessment, you know, of where the exile formations would have been, which also explains why, you know, for the next 3 years, CSC and Khotso, but Khotso in particular, you know, would have worked towards creating SEIKO, you know, which then happens in 1979. But quickly, maybe Ntate Mphahlele can tell us, what was the impact of Sibeko's assassination on the PAC? Because my sense is that, you know, with Sibeko's assassination, the PAC never really recovered.
Okay, got you loud and clear. Ntate Letlapa.
Yeah, the death of Sibeko was a huge, huge blow, because there was a trio. It was himself, Salim Salim from Tanzania, and Ruyang, who was U.S. Ambassador to the U.N. And they had, you know, a wonderful rapport, and actually, PAC was a major force, even above the ANC, at international fora, like the UN, yeah. Non-Alignment Movement, and the OAU then. And of course, his death really weakened the PAC so much that even Salim Salim, who was a very powerful figure in Tanzania, I don't think he ever forgave PAC all some of the cadres who actually killed Sibeko. And outside, that is in exile, I don't think there was any death that was devastating, a blow greater than that one of David Sibeko.
I've got a question for you from Lorato on Twitter. He asks if your path ever crossed with that of Reverend Drake Tsingeng during your time in Botswana.
Reverend who?
Tsingeng. Drake Tsingeng.
Ray.
Drake.
Drake. The Drake that I know is Drake.
Oh, maybe he had a name, Demguero.
Yes, Drake Kwaoka was a trade unionist. I think he was also very spiritual. And actually, when I got an accident, when I was knocked down by a car, it was Drake's wife who rushed me to the hospital.
Now, I just want to, I mean, I've got literally a minute left with you, but, I mean, at the opening of your book, you talk about how you had your face on newspapers, your face on TV, and you were wanted for things such as terrorism, murder, attempted murder, and arson. And of course, clearly, Bantu Olomisa General then in Transkei played a role, because part of the cars you used to escape from Mtata was a car that had been contributed to the PAC by the general. I mean, do you think his role in using Transkei then to help, you know, combatants and liberation fighters is well told to the South African society?
I don't think it has been fully acknowledged and recognized, because I think the men did much more than some of African countries did in supporting the freedom fighters.
Mm.
And when I say freedom fighters, I mean across the political line.
Yeah.
And there are others, for obvious reasons, because there was never a general amnesty. I won't talk about them. But General Olomisa was in forefront of APLA revival, especially operationally.
Yeah. Okay. Dadem Patlele, thank you so much for your time this morning and, of course, sharing this book with us as the nation.
Thanks a million. Much appreciated.
That's Litlapa Mphahlele. And if you wonder where the title of the book comes from, actually, at the end, the last paragraph of the book says, yes, we have chalked up the April 1999 victory, but Aluta continua. As the sun climbs up the sky here in Manaleng, the corrugated iron sheets crackle as they expand. I can't stand the stifling heat, and I go outside and sit under the morula, facing the ever-brooding Mulongwane. Memories of childhood climb to its summit. I stand at the top, happy to be home, but the damned bell doesn't want to be silent. Mulongwane whispers, "Welcome home, child of the soil."
You've been listening to a Power 98.7 podcast. For more podcasts, visit power987.co.za or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.